coming up on As It Happens.
Crash recourse. Nearly 2 years have passed since a cargo ship destroyed a bridge in Baltimore and killed 6 people. We will find out why several crew members from that ship are still being held in the city, despite the fact they're not facing any criminal charges.
And pride of place. A European Green Party co-chair tells us his colleagues are standing behind the mayor of Budapest, who's been charged for encouraging citizens to participate in pride events in his city.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Thursday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're listening to As It Happens here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Support for KAXE comes from Woodworks Homes, dedicated to the art of building in northern Minnesota by constructing handcrafted new homes and offering remodeling services. More at woodworksmn.com. We receive support from the Sanford Bemidji Orthopedics and Sports Medicine Center, specializing in total joint repair. More at sanfordhealth.org. Now I'm going to play a song for you. This is Bill Callahan with the song Pigeons.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash. Well, the pigeons ate the wedding rice and exploded somewhere over San Antone. Up the newlyweds and asked them where they wanted to go. They said, we don't care, we don't know anywhere, just go. Ever since I'd gotten married, I started working weddings, driving this long white limo. Had their ceremony in Brackettville at that phony Alamo. We were 30 miles from the border of Mexico. Well, they're in the back laughing about some uncle named Jack who got too drunk, and during his speech, the tears started to flow. Well, they seemed like a match, so I stopped looking for cracks in their road and just drove. Outside of Concan, the groom noticed the gold band on my left hand and said, you got any advice for us, old man? Well, I thought for a mile as I drove with a smile. I said, when you are dating, you only see each other, and the rest of us can go to hell. But when you are married, you're married to the whole wide world. The rich, the poor, the sick and the well, the straights and the gays, and the people that say we don't use those terms these days. The salt in the soil. After I'd said my piece, we drove on in silence for a spell. How my words had gone over, well, I couldn't tell. Potent advice, or preachy as hell. When I see people about to marry, I become something of a plenipotentiary. I just think it's good, as you probably can.
And that's Bill Callahan with the song Pigeons.
Went to Adams from the Big Bang, get back together with the old gang.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
No assembly required. Hundreds of auto workers in Oshawa, Ontario are working their last shifts this week as GM scales back its Canadian operations. One of them tells us he is not sure how he'll support his family now.
Troubled waters. 2 years after a ship smashed into a bridge in Baltimore, four members of its crew are still stuck in that city, even though they aren't facing criminal charges.
Following his lead, the MC of the Conservative Party's convention tells us delegates are still firmly behind Pierre Poilievre as he prepares for his leadership review.
Pride and Prejudice. The mayor of Budapest is charged for allowing pride celebrations in his own city. A member of his party says they won't let reprisals rain on anyone's parade.
Cause and Effect. After nearly 2 decades behind the mic, Paddy Daly is leaving Newfoundland and Labrador's famous call-in show, Open Line. He'll talk about some of the moments he felt the most styled in.
And where there's soak, there's fire. An intense competition pits five of Japan's laziest capybaras against one another in a contest to see who can luxuriate in the tub the longest. As it happens, the Thursday edition, radio that takes the bath of least resistance. Tonight, a lot of workers are clocking in at the General Motors plant in Oshawa, Ontario for the last time. More than 1,000 jobs will be lost as GM follows through on its plan to scale back its Canadian operations. Unions accuse the automaker of caving to tariffs and threats from U.S. President Donald Trump, but GM says it is still committed to Canada and it's keeping two shifts employed at the plant. Todd Forbes works for a GM parts supplier. He's losing his job because of the cuts. We reached him in Oshawa.
Todd, obviously this has been something you've been anticipating, preparing for months, but now all of that is a reality. So how are you doing today?
It's kind of a slow day, just looking through job applications, job postings. Indeed is probably my best friend right now online.
Right away? You haven't wasted any time?
No, I've been looking right from the beginning when we first got the notification that this was probably going to be happening, and mostly doing local job applications and resumes. And now I've expanded to go a little further out of my comfort zone.
Well, what you're saying there suggests a little bit about what the job market is looking like from where you sit. What are you seeing out there as you try to find things that suit you and that are available?
Well, one of the main things that is to do with the job market is the amount of people that are going to be on the sites trying to find jobs out there. So there's a lot more competition. And then on top of that, you've got an already high unemployment rate in our area. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely a big hill to climb. Even if it's not something that I'm fully qualified for, I'm still trying to put my name out there just to see if anybody's willing to say, hey, we'll take a chance.
Are you getting any bites? Are people saying that, even just to get in the door to have an interview?
There's been a couple of quick interviews, but nothing that's really taken off past the quick little conversation for the most part. A lot of things that I have to face are, I'm little bit older, so I'll be 49 in March, which
that's not old by any means.
No, but some companies will look at how much time do they have with you, how much time are they willing to spend on retraining you, and how much experience you have now. But I do the best I can with what I got.
What kinds of calculations are you making and budgeting are you doing? Like, what's the timeline before you really need to find something, you think?
The timeline is ASAP, really. The sooner the better. You don't really want to get too far behind on bills, and food and rent never stops, so you're constantly having to pay them. For me, I look at it like, even if it's something part-time or helping out somebody here and there, as long as I can try and make something to pay the bills for now and get through, and then, still looking at some of my options along the line of, do I need to go back to school, which I originally was kind of trying to avoid, and now it's one of the options because of the apprenticeship program and that, and that can lead to schooling for up to 5 years.
Ontario's Premier Doug Ford was at a separate news conference and talked about, you know, trying to provide support and find opportunities in other sectors, and that he said 24/7 he's going to be there for workers such as yourself. Does that reassure you at all? Do you hear positive things there?
The politically correct way to say it would be, yeah, I feel great, but in reality, I don't find much support. There's a lot of red tape with a lot of the stuff to do with the levels of government, that they could really sit down and go across the line to the other parties and really get, you know, a more balanced approach, as opposed to their current us versus you mentality. Not everybody is the smartest person in the room, but everybody together can be the smartest persons. So get together, figure it out, cut the red tape.
You mentioned all the other workers looking for jobs as well, just as you are online in that search. What does that mean for the feeling in Oshawa? What is it like there right now?
People have the sense of, you know, what are we going to do now? What else is out there? Do you want to be, you know, the next person to leave? You want to stay this area? There's a lot of talk back and forth on what's out there in the market. And one of the other factors towards finding another job is, in Oshawa, the average price for living is $31 an hour. And trying to find a job, even if it's two part-time jobs that might work together, can you make $31 an hour to be able to survive? Multiple people having to work in a household, multiple jobs. It's not like in the days where my mom and dad were kids and one parent went to work and the other parent got to stay home. Now it's the entire household has to work and support the household. It's getting overwhelming for a lot of people. And the thing is a lot of my coworkers are all different ages, anywhere from, you know, the 20s up to the 60s. And what do they have in between? What are they have for goals? Housing, job stability, that sort of thing.
GM, as you've likely heard, says it's going to be running two shifts still at the plant, and that they're preparing to build a new vehicle, a next generation of a truck there, gas, not EV. Does that leave you optimistic that you might get your job back?
So the way it sits right now, I have about 173 people with more seniority than me that are on the hunt for a new job. So as far as seniority goes, until 173 people retire or quit, the job prospect going back is a lot lower. It's not the first time that this has happened. Yeah, it won't be the last time. And it's just a steady day after day trying to figure out what I'm going to do for work and see from there.
Well, Todd, I hope we get some answers soon. I do appreciate this. Please take care.
You too. Thank you. I appreciate it.
We reached Todd Forbes in Oshawa, Ontario. It's being called a unity event and a love-in, but despite the apparently chill, groovy vibes at the Federal Conservative Convention in Calgary, party leaders are taking no chances. Pierre Poilievre has been working the phone and visiting delegates before a vote on his leadership tomorrow evening. His party has been rocked by two MP defections to the Liberals. An Abacus data poll this week showed Mr. Poilievre's personal popularity ratings among Canadians at their lowest level since 2023. And meanwhile, most polls have shown Prime Minister Mark Carney maintaining or increasing his own popularity. Calgary MP Stephanie Cousy is the master of ceremonies for the three-day convention. We reached her in Calgary.
Stephanie, as MC, what kind of energy and mood are you hoping to cultivate there?
I really believe that this convention is about Conservatives coming together after the last election. I believe that it's a time of unity for us, of the belief that we are still a movement and that we still have something to offer Canadians, something that Canadians are open to in the future. So I really see it as a convention of unity and coming together of the Conservative movement.
Our colleague J.P. Tasker in Ottawa is reporting that Pierre Poilievre has been working the phones, talking to delegates about why they need to support him in the review vote, the leadership review vote. What does that suggest about his confidence going into that vote? Is Pierre Poilievre worried about how it's going to go?
Pierre is someone who has always reached out to constituents, members, Canadians across the country. This is something that he prides himself in doing. This is something that is natural to him, is to reach out to Canadians one-on-one. So I think he sees this as a check-in with the membership, with Canadians after the last election, that he is still resonating with so many Canadians, the messages of the cost of living, the housing crisis, the productivity crisis. I really see this as just an aspect of who he is and what he does.
What's he telling you?
I have always had a very good relationship with Pierre Poilievre. He grew up in my riding. His mother still resides in my riding. I've known Pierre for decades, so he knows that I support him endlessly until his time is done in politics. I will be behind Pierre, and it's the closeness of our relationship, the trust that we have developed, that allows me to continue to support him in his role as a leader.
I hear you. You're the MC. There's a role there, but also you're his friend, and you want to support him, absolutely. But you also know recent polling from Abacus found that 48% of Canadians reported having a negative impression of Pierre Poilievre. That's a jump from their last poll in December. So what do you take away from those numbers? Because while you support and boost and our MC, there also has to be a reflection, right, at this point? So what do those numbers suggest to you?
Yeah, I think two things. I think the first thing is that the only polls that really matter are on the days where you go to election. And I think we've learned that as the Conservative Party. So I really don't read into that. What's important this weekend is for us to unify as Conservatives, prepare for an election that could be coming soon, as soon as this spring, and give our leader the support and the mandate that he needs to go forward into that election.
There were gains for your party under this leader in the last federal election. We know that, but ultimately you lost, right? And that's what so much of this reckoning has to do with. So what do you need to change? What do you think he needs to do differently, even if he stays on as leader, to get where you want to be next time?
I think that he is doing the work of reflecting why we were not successful. Last week, he put out an incredible piece, a response to the Prime Minister's speech in Davos and following in Quebec City. And I really think that it was one of thoughtful reflection and the words of a statesman. And I think that he has done a very good job of resonating with young Canadians, with Canadians who feel that they are not have not been getting ahead in the Liberal government, and they have not. I believe that the situation in Canada very clearly reflects that. But I also believe that this, I wouldn't say new side of Pierre, but this side of Pierre that he is choosing to lean into more now will provide for a new perspective for Canadians who perhaps voted Liberal in the last election, but will now consider voting Conservative now that they see this this part of him as well as a statesman.
Just tell me a little bit more, as someone who's known him for so long and as a friend, as you've said, what that new side is, what it looks like and sounds like that's different than what was shown before.
Yeah, I think with Pierre, he is a brilliant individual. He is a courageous individual. And I think we haven't seen enough of his thoughtfulness and of his compassion previously. I think perhaps, as many leaders do, they don't necessarily lean into these things. And I think he has realized that Canadians, in addition to seeing his plan for Canada, the strength that he has internally, that he shares with his message when he goes across the country, that Canadians also want to see the side of him that is thoughtful and that is the same warm and compassionate father and family man that I see to his two children and to his wife. I think he's recognizing he needs to show more of that, and he's starting to do that.
You mentioned the speech in Davos from Prime Minister Mark Carney. He received a big boost in polling after that, the Prime Minister did. The way he delivered that speech, the words he used, resonated with a lot of people, as you know, around the world. Is there an understanding, do you think, beyond the people inside the convention that perhaps Canadians want to hear a different kind of leadership than what they're seeing elsewhere in the world and what they've seen from Pierre Poilievre?
Yeah, I think that Canadians want to see a better standard of living for themselves. They want to have good jobs. They want to be able to buy a home. They want to be able to go to the grocery store and be able to pick out groceries. So while I think it's important that we certainly go and make these relationships, develop trade relationships, but Prime Minister Carney has to translate all of these trips and all of these words into results and a better standard of living for Canadians. And we're not seeing that yet. And I believe Pierre Poilievre can do that.
Stephanie, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you.
Thank you, Neil, for your time. You have a wonderful day.
You too. Take care.
Stephanie Cousy is a Calgary Conservative MP, and we reached her in Calgary. For more than 16 years, Paddy Daly was on, and he had to be. He's the host of the popular call-in program Open Line in Newfoundland and Labrador. And now, after almost two decades, he's stepping away from the microphone. And that announcement came as a shock to listeners throughout the province, especially because Mr. Daly broke the news on air this week, saying that the show he was doing would be his last show. Nevertheless, they gathered themselves to call in and wish him well. Every weekday, for 3 hours at a stretch, he would open the phone lines and field dozens of calls about just about everything, live. Big things, small things, the war in Gaza, mental health, municipal politics, family feuds, neighborly disputes, nothing was off limits. Sometimes the conversations were deeply personal, like this call from a grandmother whose 14-year-old grandson had just come out as gay.
I'm just so proud of my grandson, and I'm proud of his dad and the people that love him, accept him. Bullying, yes, that's a big thing in school, but I can remember his dad said to him, I'm going to go and talk to the teacher. And he said, no, Dad, this is my life, and I have to learn to deal with it. Now, that coming from, at that time, a 12-year-old child, it just makes me so proud to say that I'm his grandmother.
For years, Mr. Daly has been a familiar, trusted voice across Newfoundland and Labrador, and now listeners are left wondering about the future of the show. We reached Paddy Daly at home in St. John's.
Paddy, I think usually at this time of day, you'd be winding down after being on the air for 3 hours. Not an easy thing. What did you do today instead?
Well, the first thing that I found out after 16 years of the very same thing every weekday is how dependent I was on my routine.
Yes.
So I was kind of lost for a couple of hours when I first got out of bed thinking, uh-oh, no show, now what? So I did little to nothing. That was on purpose. I played with my new puppy. We went for a walk. I did some cooking and cleaning. And I'm going to have to very quickly figure out a new routine.
What was the thing that made you, the moment that made you decide that this was the time to step away from the mic?
On Monday morning, we were out in the park, and I had the proverbial walk in the snow, and I was thinking, I've got this pit in my stomach, and there's no need to feel this way, and life is too short. I've had a good run. So there's no big wind-up or build-up of issues or grievances that led me to it. I just very quickly came to the revelation that, you know what, I think I've had enough.
Monday. You decided on Monday.
I decided on Monday. I resigned at, or on Tuesday, pardon me, because I was off on Monday, Tuesday morning. And at 8:45, I told my boss I was resigning. We worked out that I would just have to do one more show, and that was that. It just happened so quickly. Even my children were a little bit dismayed that I didn't give them the heads up, but I didn't give anybody the heads up.
How did things change over those 16 years? What did you hear changing throughout all of those calls and conversations?
Well, I think anybody who's in our industry, or even people who just casually watch politics or follow politics, things have changed dramatically. I mean, the rhetoric and the way social media has been turned against us and the political figures that have been part of the discourse over the last number of years, the things have never looked more different. And I don't want to be hyperbolic, but it's kind of a dark place. I think COVID broke a lot of people, broke a lot of spirits, sent people down rabbit holes that they've never been able to climb back out of. Every time politics became the focus, it just got weirder and darker. So things changed so dramatically that I think that was part and parcel where my headspace changed. I just didn't think I had it in me to try to fight the good fight. And that shouldn't be something that a radio talk show host has to do. I shouldn't be, you know, getting down and dirty with people who have really, truly lost the plot.
Yeah, it sounds like you weren't able to have the kinds of conversations you used to have, that open line. But there's more of an onus on you in that role to push back, police, fact check everything that's going on while managing people's emotions in those moments.
Yeah, it's true. And I was pretty much a one-man show insofar as content went. I mean, I never knew what was coming until I pressed the button. And I used to really thrive on that type of pressure and the not knowing. So I was responsible for every minute of content, every question, whether it be talking to the prime minister, and I had no support and no producers, no researchers. So it just became a really weird little bubble that I lived in. And it wasn't just from 9 to 12. I mean, once again, Neil, take this for what it's worth. It's a lifestyle job. I was on all day, every day, 7 days a week, grocery store, gas station, walking the puppy, whatever. There was always someone who wanted to talk. I wanted to talk about things that I really didn't want to talk about when I was trying to get a stick of butter and a 2 liter of milk.
Our listeners heard a clip from a grandmother who called in, whose 14-year-old grandson had come out as gay. Are there others that stand out to you as really meaningful moments?
Well, sure. We took thousands of calls. You know, it went all the way from the really traumatic calls, like someone would actually call in the throes of suicidal ideations live on the program with me. So navigating that kind of stuff, and it happened maybe a handful of times over the past 16 years, all the way to things that were really inspirational. You know, like young Special Olympians or actual Olympians. I mean, I've had the Prime Minister on the program, so we went from princes to paupers to prime ministers to regular voters, every issue imaginable over the years. But my very last call in my 16-year career was, unbeknownst to me, my two sons. My children's names are Nicholas and Jack.
Yeah.
So Nick was on line one. There was a couple of calls on line two and three. Jack was on line four. Another call on line five. All of a sudden, all the other calls disappear, and I press my talk back and to my producer, are they my sons? Yep. And on they came, and it was a wonder I held it together, because between me and you,
aww,
I'm a little bit of a sookie baby, a little bit of a softie on that front, but we got through it, and that's the call that I'm going to hang on to, aww, for the rest of whatever goes on, because it was lovely and just felt right.
What did they say?
They were really happy for me, and they saw how much the job meant to me and how proud they were, and you know, a little love fest, and that was it. It was extremely nice way to put a bow on it. It was a great bookend to what I've been told is a pretty great career. So I'm forever grateful to the company, mm-hmm, and to the listeners and to the tweeters and the emailers and whoever. You know, it was a wild ride. Sometimes it felt like I was a member of the Flying Willenda.
It's such a beautiful thing that your sons surprised you. You said you didn't get another job offer, but you've also said you're not necessarily retired. So what's next?
I suppose what all other washed-up members of the media will do, I'll start a podcast, I suppose.
The mic is not too far away, is what you're saying.
Maybe not, but I promised myself that I was really just going to take a couple of days to decompress. Yeah. And the reaction that I've gotten since I made the announcement has been overwhelming. I've gotten thousands of messages. I knew it would have maybe had some impact on some people, but it's been overwhelming. And I'm going to just take a deep breath. And when I get out of bed on Monday morning next week, then I'll figure it out.
Yeah, take more than a few days, Patty. Relax.
Yeah.
Have some fun for yourself. I'm really glad we could speak. Congratulations, and thank you for this, Patty.
Thanks for having me.
Patty Daly is now the former host of the radio call-in show Open Line in Newfoundland and Labrador. We reached him in St. John's. Hello, sports fans, and welcome back to this nail-biter of a competition in which five of the finest athletes in Japan battle for supremacy. Let's check in on the action. Well, Hachima turning her head slightly. Well, now she's turned it back. Nobody's doing anything now. Hachima, of course, known as the Watermelon Queen. She's won the Watermelon Eating Contest four summers in a row now. Prune looking relaxed there in the bath. See the intensity of concentration, the laser focus that really... Oh, she's asleep. Actually, it looks like all of our competitors are asleep. Just tremendous discipline we're seeing here. Earlier this month, Japan was transfixed by the Capybara Long Bath Showdown. Five zoos, five capybaras, five baths. Who would soak the longest? The drama started early, as Shita from the Ishikawa Zoo chose the unusual strategy of leaving her bath after 17 seconds, which ultimately backfired because she instantly lost. Next, Hachima, a local hero at the Saitama Children's Zoo Park due to her watermelon gobbling prowess, left her bath because, in the end, she did not know she was in a competition. Then there were three. Things got tense, in the sense that they stayed relaxed, but they kept going. And in the end, it was Prune from the Nagasaki Biopark who emerged dripping and emerged victorious after 1 hour, 45 minutes, and 18 seconds. How did she do it? Well, simply by not getting out. Afterwards, she told a press conference... Oh! Well, so she's a little overexcited there, I guess, but she has a right to be. She competed very slowly, but then she won very suddenly. Here's Royal Canoe with Bathtubs. Royal Canoe with Bathtubs.
A short break for us now. When we return, nearly 2 years after the deadly bridge collapse in Baltimore, crew members from the ship that hit it are still being held in the U.S., and they have no idea when they'll be allowed to go home.
And no ifs, ands, or especially buts. Nearly 4 years after he was fired for reading a book called I Need a New Butt to School Children, former assistant principal in Mississippi will finally be reinstated. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. I dread free. I dread free.
It is 6:35, and you're listening to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with your volunteer host, DJ Lake Poseidon. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. We receive support from Hug Hydronics, committed to making in-floor heating simple, providing in-floor heating solutions for both commercial and residential. More information at hughydronics.com. And support for KAXE comes from Ledger & Ladle, a restaurant in downtown Grand Rapids with a rotating menu every few months to explore a new region, technique, or ingredient. Open Wednesday through Friday, 3 to 9 p.m., Saturdays, 5 to 9, and Sundays, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. More at ledgerandladle.com. Weather tonight, partly cloudy skies, lows 12 to 20 below, wind chill values around 20 to 30 below. Tomorrow, sunny, high 0 to 9 degrees.
It's been nearly 2 years now since a cargo ship lost power and crashed into the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, causing it to collapse and killing six people. For 3 months after the accident, 21 crew members on the MV Dali were stuck on board the ship. Most of them have since returned home, but four are still in Baltimore. They're being held without charge and without any indication of when they'll be able to go home. Reverend Joshua Messick is the executive director of the Baltimore International Seafarers Center. He's been supporting the crew members during their extended stay in the U.S. We reached him in Baltimore.
Reverend, who are the four crew members still being held in Baltimore?
So there's the captain, the chief engineer, the electrician, and the second officer. They're the ones that have been here this whole time. They haven't been home at all.
And where are they being held?
They are in extended stay hotels, essentially. They're a step below apartments. They're relatively nice, but they're not home.
Yeah, no. And I ask because I remember in our previous coverage, in our earlier coverage, in our conversation with you, they were on that ship for quite some time, the entire crew.
They were. They were stuck on board until it was brought back alongside after they detonated the portion of the bridge that was resting on the deck of the ship.
These men are not facing any criminal charges. You've said that they're cooperating with the investigation. So why are they still there?
It's complicated. The investigation is ongoing. The proceedings are ongoing. So they're here to continue to act as witnesses. The National Transportation Safety Board released a report that exonerated them and commended them for their actions, but the Department of Justice can take or leave that report. They don't have to use it. And since everything continues to move on DOJ's time, everything is still moving along.
And so what's your sense of how they're doing?
They are still just in a holding pattern. They don't have anything to do on a day-to-day basis, and they're used to working constantly. So that's been difficult. They can't keep up with their credentials, their sea time. They're going to fall behind in promotions. There's just nothing they can do. So it's been an emotional drain. Some of them have been able to have their families come and visit them, but not for very long. And it's just not the same as being in your home country. One of them that's still here speaks a different language than the rest. He speaks Hindi. The rest speak Tamil. So he's been doubly isolated this whole time.
Oh, and the families that can't come to visit that are overseas, I mean, we're talking about 2 years.
Right. Yes, one of the crew members has a child that just turned 7, and he hasn't seen him since he was a 5-year-old. And as the father of a 5-year-old, that one really hits hard to miss 2 years of a child's life.
Is there any sense at this stage what kind of timeline they're looking at now?
I have no idea. Honestly, it's all in the hands of the federal government at this point.
And doing the work that you do, what kind of help or support are you able to offer them?
So we are in touch with the crew members regularly, not quite daily, but several times a week. We go and visit, provide them transportation to the local Indian grocery store to get groceries regularly. We host them at our Seafarers Center and have meals together. We just offer a sense of stability the best that we can someone that, you know, they know is available, someone that's there whenever they need someone they can talk to. So we maintain that level of support.
In terms of how people in Baltimore are feeling, you know, your neighbors, folks you're talking to, about the whole catastrophe and these four men, I mean, are they being blamed at all?
That is not my sense, generally. And I know that I'm biased because I work directly with them. But from what I've heard and seen online and in conversations, they're really not quite celebrated, but praised for their actions. They really did everything they could. There was nothing that could have been done. The faulty wiring that was responsible was behind a panel that no one had access to, so they couldn't have performed a regular inspection on it. Their actions helped save lives. I think that the general feeling towards them is one of heartfelt sympathy. These are men who are stuck in a difficult situation through no fault of their own, and they're keenly aware that lives were lost, but still they did everything that they could.
Well, there were crew members, of course, who were allowed to go back to their homes. What's your sense of how they're doing?
They're struggling, in all honesty. They as long as they remain here in Baltimore and are under the care of the company as part of the investigation, they are being paid. But when they leave, if they are not coming back, they don't get that pay anymore. And the ones that have gone are having a hard time being hired again. As I said earlier, they were exonerated by this report, but that doesn't make it any easier for them to find work again, being part of a situation like this. So seafarers as a whole tend to only know how to be seafarers. It's really hard for them to find other occupations. And so the men that have gone home have had a hard time trying to support their families still.
Reverend, I appreciate this. Thank you for your time.
No problem. Happy to help.
Reverend Joshua Messick is the executive director of the Baltimore International Seafarers Center. We reached him in Baltimore. We contacted the U.S. Department of Justice, but we haven't heard back at the time of air. Nine years ago today, a gunman opened fire at a mosque in Quebec City, killing six people and injuring 19. Ayman Derbali was among the injured. He was paralyzed from the chest down. And now he says Islamophobia has not declined in Quebec as he'd hoped it would. Here's Mr. Derbali talking about what he remembers from that day and how he believes Quebec's recent secularism laws have undermined understanding.
I thought that this is the end. It was the end. For me, the end of life. And when I closed my eyes, for me, it was the last, I closed my eyes for the last time in this life. But when I woke up in the hospital, I was very, in the beginning, I thought that the hospital was in the heaven. I woke up in the heaven. My duty is to contribute or to be involved in fighting Islamophobia. Okay, this is my duty for the memory of all the victims and for all the people that are victims of Islamophobia. So I need to raise my voice and to be active in fighting Islamophobia, the rising Islamophobia. Unfortunately, we see that Islamophobia is rising in Quebec since this tragedy. The three laws together, they are preventing women wearing a veil from working in the education system, on all the education system, even in the private kindergarten, even in private kindergarten. So they would not be able to work with a veil. This is the problem, because we receive it since that we receive it. I see a lot of comments of hate. I would like to know, what is the problem of seeing a woman wearing a veil? What is the freedom? What is all the freedoms? The freedom of wearing whatever we want, the freedom of speech, the freedom of religion, the freedom of conscience. All the freedoms that we hear about in the federal, in Canada, we don't see them in Quebec. It's like we are living in an island, isolated island.
That was Ayman Derbali, a survivor of the 2017 Quebec City mosque attack, speaking to CBC Quebec. For a lot of people, Pride is just a fantastic party. It can get a little wild, but you don't expect to be criminally charged at the end of it. Nevertheless, that's what's happened to Gergely Karácsony, the mayor of Budapest. Last year, the government of Viktor Orbán pushed a piece of legislation banning Pride events in the name of protecting children. Mayor Karácsony, who is part of the European Green Party, went ahead and sanctioned the event anyway, and thousands of people showed up. And no one faced any legal repercussions for the event until now. 7 months later, Hungarian prosecutors have charged the mayor. He'll likely face fines. Kieran Cuff was at last year's Pride celebrations. He's the co-chair of the European Green Party, and we reached him in Brussels.
Kieran, what did it feel like to be in that crowd last summer?
There was an amazing feeling of empowerment to walk the streets of Budapest along with 200,000 other people in a city and in a country where there has been certainly a clampdown on the freedom of expression. Was an extraordinary experience.
I saw a photograph, you were head to toe in a sharply tailored pink suit, looked great. What were you hearing from those you were marching with?
Well, I think there was a real sense of frustration, because for people in Budapest, for people in Hungary, they're looking to the rest of Europe. They're looking to the rest of the European Union, where there is strong democracy, a strong advocacy of rule of law, and the ability to speak your mind and not face the power of the state pushing down on you. I think Viktor Orban, in many senses, he is an outlier. He is an example of big man politics that oppresses the freedom of expression of smaller voices, of different voices. And I know we've seen a move to the right in Europe in recent years, with Meloni in Italy, with leaders like Fico, in the Czech Republic, in Slovakia. We see these voices on the right, but Orban epitomizes the rightward trend in European politics. And it's a cause of real concern. And I think that is why 200,000 people hit the streets last summer.
You're Irish. You're not from Hungary. What made you decide to be there in that crowd? You could advocate in other ways, certainly. Why did you want to be there in person?
I'm the co-chair of the European Green Party, and we represent Green parties all around the European Union and beyond. So in countries like Ukraine, in countries like Belarus, we speak out for freedom of expression and for democracy. And I think in a world where independent voices are increasingly being silenced, it was hugely important not just to speak out, but to be actually there on the streets of Budapest, to sit down with civil organizations, to listen to the concerns that they have. And it's not just about LGBTQI plus groups. It is also about having an independent media and allowing voices from across the political spectrum to be heard, including my own Green Party.
You mentioned that you think Orban is an outlier. People may disagree with you on that. I mean, do you think he's an outlier on this issue, despite the shift to the right?
I think he is. I think it's most unusual for a country's leader to try and shut down a pride parade in 2025. And yes, we've seen examples of oppression elsewhere in Central Europe, but this was the leader of a member state of the European Union.
The Associated Press is quoting the mayor, who says he doesn't dispute what prosecutors are saying, and quote, "That is exactly what happened." He goes on to say, "I will never accept nor resign myself to the idea that in my homeland it could be a crime to stand up for freedom," unquote. And he does go on from there. We know the prosecutor's office is recommending he face a fine without a trial. Have you had a chance to speak with the mayor when you were there or since?
I did, and I have met him in Brussels since then. He is part of the European Green family, and we are very proud of the expression he has given to the people of his city. He faces threats not only from this possible fine for the parade going ahead, even though he was not a direct organizer of that, but he has also faced a thumbscrew being turned on the city's budget, which makes it increasingly difficult for him, along with his colleagues, to invest in the city.
What's your sense of why these charges are coming now, months and months after?
I'm curious as to why this is proceeding now. But it's got to be remembered that there is a national election in Hungary on the 12th of April. That's just a few short months away. And perhaps there is a move from Fidesz, from Orban's party, to see this as a vote-winning strategy to further clamp down on progressive and liberal voices in Hungary. And maybe this is his way of doing it. Or maybe the fine was handed down independently from the local judiciary or police force. I haven't seen the detail of this. Mm. But I would not be surprised if Viktor Orban, as Prime Minister of Hungary and as a lead candidate in the election campaign, is worried that his vote is diminishing, and he's picking enemies in order to consolidate his own vote base.
What's your sense? Do you think it will work?
I don't think so. The polling is quite a mix at the moment, but I think the trend in the opinion polling we're seeing in Hungary is saying that Viktor Orban is in trouble. And if Orban is in trouble, it means democracy has a chance to shine. I'm not saying Orban is not a democrat, but certainly he has used autocratic and authoritarian methods in his rule over that country in recent years. And his star is not shining as brightly as it once did.
The Pride Parade, the support for it, is getting international attention. I wonder what your sense is of how the community is feeling in Hungary right now. There's support from around the world, but still so much political pressure domestically.
I think they're concerned, and I think those advocating and standing up for LGBTQI plus rights or trans rights, they do feel threatened. They feel threatened by the policies in the current US administration. They feel threatened by certain voices in Central Europe, in Italy, in the Czech Republic, in Slovakia, and they feel the need to stand up. So I think what you saw marching in Budapest was not just those advocating for gay rights. We also saw those advocating for democracy. And it was great that we found common cause on all of those issues on a blazingly hot day as we walked through the downtown streets of Budapest.
Kieran, I'm so glad we could speak. Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Kieran Cuff is the co-chair of the European Green Party. He's in Brussels. Toby Price could never have imagined he would have to fight so long about something so ridiculous. But then he never imagined he'd get fired because of a book called I Need a New Butt. 4 years ago, the former assistant principal was let go after reading that book to grade two students at Gary Road Elementary School in Mississippi. It's a deliberately silly story about a boy who's trying to figure out how he got a crack in his butt and how to find a new butt without a crack to replace it. And the kids loved it, but obviously the local school district did not. Well, this week, a Mississippi court said that the board had had no right to fire Mr. Price and ordered the district to reinstate him. In its decision, the court wrote, "There is nothing concrete in the record demonstrating that the second grade class was subjected to unnecessary embarrassment." In March of 2022, Mr. Price was a guest on As It Happens. He told guest host Jillian Findlay the whole debacle made no sense.
"I know my audience, you know, second grade reluctant readers. You got to show them the books can be fun and silly and engaging. You know, you want them to put down their phone and pick up a book."
And were these officials responding to criticisms or complaints that they had received, or were they just anticipating and so they were going to get out in front of this?
They were anticipating. And when they called me back on Thursday, the one thing that was said over and over again by the superintendent was, "I just can't get past this." It was I. The one complaint I've had from parents from the school is that they're upset that I'm not there and more upset that this happened.
Is there anything that you can see that could be construed as being inappropriate for a grade two class in this book?
No, I mean, it's a cartoon. It's a cartoon about butts. if you look at Captain Underpants, you look at Diary of a Wimpy Kid, you know, the Wonky Donkey, all famous, broadly accepted books, especially like Captain Underpants, where they hypnotize their principal to fight crime in his underwear. These are all broadly accepted, and it's not a big deal.
So what's going on here then, do you think?
I think it may have been one person's knee-jerk reaction. And honestly, I think they expected me to just resign and walk away. They left me in a room and to decide what to do. They had resignation paperwork. And I called my wife, and my wife told me, she said, "You know, if you sign that resignation, it's almost like you're walking away saying that they were right." So I stood up and put my chin up, sucked in all my tears, and walked out of the building and let them know I was leaving and I would not be resigning, and got in my car and cried all the way home.
A lot of this is humorous, but you have lost your job. What does that mean for you and your family?
Exactly. I have three kids, two of which have severe autism. You know, this is not just a road bump for us. This is, two flat tires and we're stuck on the side of the road. What do we do kind of situation? I have to find a way to figure out how I'm going to take care of them.
Are you at all optimistic that this might end with you getting your job back?
Maybe. I don't expect the district to back down, but at the same time, I'd be lying to you if I told you I would just like walk right back in and everything would be okay. You know, my wife and I, we're special needs parents. We plan everything down to a T. All the uncertainty is just, it's killing us. It's making our anxiety go through the roof.
If you could do it all over again and could go back in time, would you choose another book, do you think?
If I had it to do over again, I'd pick a book that kids find engaging and fun that they'll laugh at. And you know what? I would have picked it again. The world's depressing enough.
From our archives, former Mississippi Assistant Principal Toby Price talking to Jillian Findlay in March of 2022.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.
This is 91.7 KEXE Grand Rapids.